The central message in the book, The Humane Economy by Wayne Pacelli, is that industries which have animal cruelty sort of built into their bottom lines had better pay attention to the wishes of the public, because the public is definitely engaged on many levels. And we've just heard an hour of examples from SeaWorld to Ringling Brothers to the egg industry of how things are changing. The book also has a chapter which we haven't touched on yet that gives advice to individuals about how you can make a difference in your own life. It doesn't mean you have to become a vegan, but you can make changes and pay attention to the source of the food that you buy and make a major difference. So we'll see if we can touch on that. We'll open up the phone lines a little bit later with a couple of your questions and comments and much more to cover with my guest Wayne Pacelli here on Coast to Coast AM. Wayne Pacelli, I wanted to give you a chance to finish the thought before the break. We were talking about the AHA, this organization that's got the duty of keeping an eye on movie producers. And I think I remember from your book, you had an example of where producers who want to get away with some cruelty in the production of a movie will have the inspector and take him out for coffee at the time that some particular scene is about to be filmed. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, there are cases like that. You can basically, you know, get around a single person on a very complex production set. But the other problem, George, that's an inherent one with these wild animal actors, if you will, is that the animal trainers do the abuse at the site where they keep the animal. So if you've got chimpanzees who are making a brief appearance in a film, they might beat the heck out of the chimp, you know, at the facility where the animal is being maintained, and then bring them, you know, onto the set. So you would never see the abuse on the set. The abuses occur because of the inherent problems in kind of training and coercing these animals. So that's why computer-generated imagery as a solution to keep the animals at the center of our storytelling, but with no abuse, is such an incredible innovation, and it's really a marker of the humane economy.
Sort of along the same lines, wondering whether the admonitions that we see, that statements, for example, that a movie is cruelty-free. The same thing with, like, I say about cage-free eggs, and I wonder, can we trust those kind of labels if we think we're paying a few pennies more for something that is a less cruel product? Is it accurate?
You know, I would say it's not always 100% accurate, but these terms mean something in the real world. And, you know, one of our arguments is not just that, you know, the animals are kind of generally mistreated, but that the production system where the animals are confined so severely that they can't move has inherent problems. So when you say cage-free, you don't necessarily guarantee that the animals are out on a pasture. If you want hens living in an environment where they're walking on grass and they're frolicking about, that is a free-range or pasture-based system. And some of the language on egg cartons will stipulate that. When it's cage-free, the animals may be in a warehouse. They're just not in a small cage. We think that's an improvement, but we also don't want to go too far and say that it's perfect, because it's far from perfect. So this is what's happening in the marketplace, is we're getting a little bit more specific with the details of what's happening to these animals, and that's where it's left up to us as consumers to make the most responsible choices we can to then drive the marketplace, which then drives producers to treat the animals better. When we don't tolerate animal cruelty as consumers, then that's going to change the production practices back on the farm.
Let me ask you this. I know people who have given up meat altogether. They didn't have that much trouble doing it, but they can't give up cheese. Is there such a thing as cruelty-free cheese out there?
Well, of course, you know, meat comes from the flesh and the body of animals. I mean, you essentially, unless you're consuming roadkill, which not many of us are, those animals have to be killed to get a piece of steak or a piece of pork or a piece of chicken. The dairy and the eggs are reproductive products. These are the products of female animals, cows for milk and hens for eggs. And no animal need be harmed through the normal reproductive processes of these creatures. The challenge comes with the industrial production of these animals, and the issue with the laying hens, in particular, of course, is the one we've talked about, the cage confinement. Now, you don't have to confine the animal that severely, and you can let a chicken out in a pasture, and it's actually a pretty darn good life, and I don't think there's any moral problem associated with that. With dairy production, there shouldn't be any problem with the normal reproductive process of producing milk. We happen to be the only species that drinks the milk of another species. But the big issue in dairy production is the treatment of the animals, but also the genetics. We have changed the fundamental way that these animals live and reproduce. So the cows are basically kept pregnant all the time, and their udders are so large, and they're now so productive that the average industrial-style dairy cow is producing 27,000 pounds of milk a year. That is so far beyond what the normal cow, unmanipulated by this sort of selective breeding for hyperproduction, would produce. I mean, a dairy cow that is in a more humane sort of setting that hasn't been manipulated might produce 7,000 or 8,000 pounds of milk, but not 27,000. So that really stresses them. So yes, you can get cheese that comes from more humane sources, but you know, you've got to have some representations that the animal is living in a proper environment and not on this incredible production pathway where, you know, a lot of these dairy cows are only living 3, 4, 5 years. They can live to 14 or 15 because they're so stressed, because their body is under so much pressure to produce.
A lot of the battles that you fight, you know, are in boardrooms or in the halls of power in Washington with Congress. I think about, you know, how paralyzed Congress is on pretty much everything. I can't imagine that they're able to get anything done on animals, that they're not beholden to these giant agribiz conglomerates. And that the examples that pop up that come to mind are things that happened on public lands. You know, the idea that wolves have been reintroduced into parts of the upper, you know, West drives cattle ranchers and sheep ranchers crazy. They want to kill them all. They want to fly in planes and shoot them out of the sky. And there are millions of dollars spent on federal programs every year to eliminate predators on public land so that people can use it for cattle. I can imagine the kinds of reactions you get from Congress and from regulators, supposed regulators, when you champion the cause of wolves.
Yeah, it's one of these strange issues. And in the book, George, as you know, because I know you read it so carefully as we've talked about it, you know, I really credit the wolf with helping human civilization develop. I mean, it was the wolf who spawned the domesticated dog, the first of any of the domesticated creatures. And the dog's role in providing security, herding, hunting, human companionship was one of the great moments in all of human history and prehistory. We wouldn't be where we are as a civilization without the dog. And I talk in detail about this in the book, The Humane Economy. So it's ironic to me, in light of that, that we humans are treating wolves in this way. The creatures who morphed into dogs, now we have these Little Red Riding Hood fairy tales about them. We exaggerate their hazard or their risk to us. We don't credit the ecological benefits that they bring. You know, in the Yellowstone ecosystem, the Yellowstone National Park is the heart of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. There are tens of millions of dollars generated because people want to go to Yellowstone to see wolves. They also want to go see grizzly bears. And these are the actors that animate these incredible natural landscapes. These are the creatures that excite us, that cause our pulse and our heart rate to quicken. And, you know, ranchers and trophy hunters want to kill them for these kind of 19th century and 18th century reasons that, you know, they fear them or they're going to liquidate all their livestock. It's just false. And what I talk about in the book is how wolves provide incredible ecological services, that they are driving tourism, that they're part of the humane economy, and we've got to get our policymakers, you know, in better alignment with the values of the American public.
Talk to me about Congress. When you walk in to speak to a senator or representative, Did they recognize that you speak for a heck of a lot of people? Did they give you a time of day, or I guess it depends on who it is.
Yeah, things are changing, George, for the better. Now, it's not to say that we don't have immense challenges, but there are 25,000 animal welfare groups in the United States. There are local organizations helping every kind of animal. Then you've got broad-ranging organizations like the Humane Society of the United States. Within the last 10 years, we've helped pass more than 1,000 laws at the state level. In fact, just at 6 a.m. this morning at the state level in Rhode Island, in Providence, Rhode Island became the first state to ban the use of bull hooks for use in circuses. It's the first of our 50 states. I think California is going to follow very soon. But things are changing at the state level, even though the battles are often very difficult. At the federal level, we've got a lot of great allies in the Congress and many, many animal advocates who stand up for animal protection. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey is one. Senator David Vitter of Louisiana is another. Democrat, Republican, different ideological views on so many issues of the day, but aligned on animal protection. One of the things that just happened in Congress is they upgraded the Toxic Substances Control Act. This is a 1976 statute that regulates tens of thousands of chemicals in commercial use in our society. Animal testing was the way that they did risk assessment for these chemicals. It was not predictive. It was wasteful. It was wasteful of the lives of animals. The new measure that they passed that the president should be signing this coming week basically says that animal testing should be a last resort. We're going to use 21st century technology. This was a bipartisan effort to get something done. It's a major, major advance against animal testing and for 21st century science. So there are some good news stories occasionally.
On the issue of ivory, it seems to me it goes back and forth. It's hard to believe that it would not be a totally ban, but I read something that came out from HSUS in the last couple of weeks that said talked about the U.S. Fish and Wildlife announcing a near complete ban. How can it not be banned already?
Well, it's incredible, George, and you ask about how things happen in Congress. Well, the NRA, the National Rifle Association, has fought our efforts to stem the trade in ivory, and they are essentially willing to put elephants at risk in Africa from poachers because there are some guns that are in circulation that have a little piece of ivory on it, and they don't want the federal government to regulate the future sale of a gun that someone has in his possession. Now, the new rule that the Obama administration passed to restrict just about any sale of ivory does create some de minimis exceptions for small amounts of ivory that people can document existed as an heirloom or a gun or some other product before 1973, before the elephants were in trouble. So, but this is the way that Washington works, that the NRA calls the tune, and they had language in spending bills to prevent the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service from making final the new rules to crack down on the ivory trade. We were able to defeat them on this issue, but it was a fight, and it's shocking that we even had to have that kind of fight.
Same kind of question on shark fins. Sharks, as I've talked about previously, they don't have very good PR. People think about sharks, they think of Jaws, but they're so vital to the oceans and the ecosystem and the health of the oceans, and they're such amazing creatures, and yet millions of them per year are killed just for their fins. It's really cruel, as you know. The fins are cut off, the animals are thrown back into the ocean to drown, basically slowly to die, and this fins are used to produce soup that's has no taste to speak of. It has no nutritional value. It's unbelievable that that battle is still being fought.
Well, this is one of those things that, again, we're so detached from it. I mean, what happens with the sharks is the fins are detached from their bodies and the animals die, but we are physically detached from seeing what goes on. If we could see the sharks, caught by the millions and then have their fins hacked off and the rest of their bodies thrown into the water, any decent person is going to be appalled by that. Whether you love sharks or you just recognize that sharks play a vital role in the ecology of our marine ecosystems, you come to the same conclusion that that's wasteful and it's cruel. The good news on this, George, is that, thanks to the incredible reporting that you did in Las Vegas on television on this issue and other journalists have done, we're now becoming much more aware of this issue. And 10 states, including Rhode Island, which just passed a bill last week, the ocean state of Rhode Island, it's a small state, but it's got some a decent fishing industry there. They're banning shark finning. California has done it, Oregon, Hawaii, a number of other states, and we're about to get a federal rule, and we're going to see federal legislation introduced probably in the next couple of weeks, perhaps even this coming week, to ban any interstate sale of shark fins in the United States. This will be another great advance because the estimate, as you know, George, globally is up to 73 million sharks killed every year in the world, in our oceans, most of it for shark fin soup.
You know, when we've covered sort of environmentally themed programs talking about the health of the oceans, and we get into the issue of overfishing, and a lot of people have trouble buying that. They have trouble believing that there could be such a thing as fishing too much, that parts of the ocean could be overfished to the point of exhaustion. Where are you on that one?
Oh, you know, I mean, my God, I'm actually shocked that anyone could be in denial about that. I mean, this is the classic case of the tragedy of the commons, that you have this common resource that so many coastal nations draw from for their commercial fishing industries. And the problem is that, you know, what if one country says, well, I want to get my big heap, and then another country says, well, I don't want them taking that much without our taking just as much, and everybody takes too big a scoop, and there's nothing left for anybody. That's called the tragedy of the commons. And that's what we've seen with commercial fishing. And too often, our government turns over the regulatory kind of decision-making to the industry itself, that the industry and the government regulators are one and the same. And what we need is a much more independent, science-based regulatory authority to set proper rules on these issues. And, you know, it's not just about the fish. It's also about the bycatch, the collateral costs of these fishing practices, where you're kind of strip mining the oceans. You're going after one species, but you're catching many others. You know, for shrimp, for instance, for, you know, so many of the methods of shrimping, you know, for every pound of shrimp, you get 10 pounds of other fish that are caught in that process, and just about all of them are thrown away.
Wow. Wow. And on that issue, I mean, is the fishing industry, as powerful as like the beef industry? Do they fight you tooth and nail in Congress and block progress on these kinds of things?
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, the fishing industries in the coastal states, you know, have had a lot of power through the years, and they have controlled a lot of the regulation making that exists. And, you know, we've seen terrible outcomes because of mismanagement of our marine resources. You know, the cod populations in the Northeast were decimated because of overfishing. We've seen on the West Coast decimation of other fisheries. So we're starting to do a little bit better in this area, but again, the political influence of these different commodity groups that say, oh, you know, you're going to threaten our jobs if you want to place more restrictions on what we're doing. And again, the thesis in my book, The Humane Economy, is that if we don't properly account for animals, if we don't protect the populations, then we're really going to be doing a disservice to these resource users. You know, that the factory farmers on land are actually damaging farming because of their extreme practices. And I think sometimes you see this in the commercial fishing industry, that they do harm to themselves by overutilizing the resources that they have in the oceans.
We're talking with Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, about his new book, The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. In a moment, we're going to open up the phone lines with your questions and comments. And still to come in the next hour, the issue of trophy hunting. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the U.S., about his new book, The Humane Economy. In a moment, we'll open up the phone lines with some questions and comments from you, the listeners. We'll be right back. Wayne Pacelli, before the break, we were talking about sort of what you run into, the political power that you run into when you try to get something done in Congress. I got a release from HSUS that came out back in February about this package of bills, the Sportsman's Heritage and Recreational Enhancement Act, SHARE, which sounds really great. It seemed to have been passed, at least out of the House, as something that would be good for rank-and-file hunters. And it was anything but. Do you remember that?
Yes, it's a disgraceful bill. It's a grab bag of the most extreme hunting wishes of the trophy hunting lobby in Congress. And as you say, it's packaged as a bill to help the rank and file sportsman, the guy who shoots a deer and fills his freezer with venison or hunts ducks. It has nothing to do with any of that. It basically tries to bar the federal government from restricting the use of poisonous lead ammunition, even though now we have steel and copper and bismuth shot that hunters can use. And that spent ammunition is not going to poison 10 to 20 million animals as lead does. It's about allowing this bunch of elite American trophy hunters who've already killed rare polar bears when they realized that they were going to be listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. These guys ran up and shot polar bears in northern Canada, in the Northwest Territories, and now they're pleading their case to Congress to let their polar bear trophies come in. I mean, this is just a millionaire's provision, because none of these guys is a rank-and-file sportsman. These are people who are globe-trotting and shooting the rarest species in the world for their dens. And it has a number of other provisions like that, like expanding commercial trapping on our national wildlife refuges and other federal lands. I mean, what does that have to do with regular rank-and-file sportsmen? So we've been working to block this bill, but it's a tough, tough fight because it's a priority of the NRA and the Safari Club. And these groups have inordinate sway in Congress, even though their practices that they're defending are deeply unpopular with the American public.
Well, let's take a couple of calls. We'll start with the wild card line, Charles in Baltimore. Hi, Charles. You're on with Wayne Pacelli.
Yes, thank you very much. Alligators. What do they purpose? Do they, what purpose do they serve? And okay, food, for example, you're standing, right near the shore, like say, like you would on the beach of the ocean, where the water comes up. If you're that close, and you're like making a tape or taking pictures of it. Do you have a chance of being grabbed like that poor little kid was? And what about when I had an experience one time that really scared me. I was at a motel in Florida. It was in Deltona. I don't know if you know where that is. I'm not sure where that is really right now. But anyway, I heard this alligator in this water a little distance away, and I thought, uh-oh, suppose he comes up after me. What in the world would I do? So...
Well, okay, Charles, Wayne, I imagine you got a lot of questions about alligators in the last couple of days.
Yes, I do. Obviously, all saddened by the boys killing in Orlando. Orlando has dealt with too much tragedy lately, and this was part of that. And, it was just a freak accident and a freak circumstance. We don't see much of this. There are a very, very limited number of cases of alligators attacking people. But now Florida has probably now millions of alligators, and people realize that they're part of the ecology of Florida. And, people need to be alert. And that doesn't mean that we're always going to be able to stop the very rare occasional incident. But the real problem is human attacks on alligators. People are killing alligators for sport, for trophies. It's really doing nothing to regulate the population, if you will, and reduce total numbers. It's just more of a sport-killing thing. But, there are powerful animals who live among us, alligators in Florida, mountain lions in the west, grizzly bears in the northern Rockies. And, I think our view on this at the Humane Society of the United States is that these animals deserve their place in the world as well, that generally they stay away from us. We pose more of a threat to them than they do to us. If there are dangerous circumstances, then we need to proactively deal with those, occasionally even killing these animals when there's a circumstance where they become menacing. But those are rare circumstances, and we should not take the few individual cases, you know, where there was an adverse animal action against the person, and then have kind of a broad attack on all other members of that species. That just doesn't make sense.
Well, it'd be like saying we should attack the remaining gorillas because of what happened at the zoo.
I imagine
that's one you got a lot of calls about as well.
Yes, I mean that case in Cincinnati with the little boy basically, you know, wandering down into the enclosure and then falling in, and you know, no one really knows for sure what was in that gorilla's mind, but a lot of people think that he was engaging in pretty protective behavior of the boy, although he was probably agitated by all the people screaming, and the zoo shot this mountain gorilla. And it was a tragedy, and so many of us were upset. You know, in my blog, I called on you know, if a similar circumstance resulted, if you're going to have this rare circumstance where a little boy is in with a gorilla, have a tranquilizer, try to trank the animal. If the animal then gets agitated, then you have a backup shooter. But shooting him first, I didn't think was the right response, although of course, it was playing out real time, and it's easy to second guess that.
On the wild card line, BJ in Santa Cruz. Hi, you're on with Wayne Pacelli.
Hi, George. Thank you for your programs on against animal cruelty. Thank you, thank you, and thank you, Wayne. I've been watching Dr. Joel Fuhrman on public television, and he's saying study after study is now conclusive and irrefutable that eliminating meat and dairy reduces high blood pressure, strokes, heart attacks, dementia, better than using prescription drugs, and of course without all of the toxic side effects. In fact, there's a study, I think it's called the Kijava study, which shows that people who are 100% vegetarian did not suffer from any of the above diseases. Thank you.
Yes, BJ, Dr. Fuhrman is really a highly credible person in the medical field, and there's just no doubt. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming that a plant-based diet done properly is you know, very, very potent in maintaining health and all but eliminating heart disease. So I agree. I talk about it in my book, The Humane Economy, where I really say that we need kind of a full accounting for the meat industry. It's not just the animal cruelty in the factory farms. It's not just the immense manure management, but there are immense public health costs to this diet that is so rich in animal protein. We Americans eat 220 pounds of meat a year, per capita consumption that's higher than any other country in the world, and there is a direct causal relationship between that and higher rates of cancer and heart disease, no question about it.
We'll try Chris, who is trucking in Nebraska. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me on. First off, sure. I want to say it's a great show, and I want to thank your guest for everything he does. The one concern that I have of many, you don't hear anybody talk about the wild Mustangs over in like Wyoming and stuff that are being rounded up, sold to Mexican government. For me, they're being rounded up on BLM land, public land, and the federal government just let it happen.
Yeah, that's an issue that we've covered before. We have the fourth hour of tonight's program is going to deal with wild horses and horses in general. So I hope you'll stick around for that, Chris. But while we have Wayne here, maybe he can address the difficulty of getting progress in dealing with BLM on the management of wild horses.
Well, thanks for the question, Chris. A very important one. And George, our host tonight, has done amazing reporting on this issue in Nevada, which has about half the wild horses in the United States. And, you know, this has been a case of our government mismanaging wild horses and not fulfilling its responsibilities under the law. We've been rounding up wild horses, partly because ranchers consider them competitors for forage with cattle and sheep in the West. And we've been unable to adopt so many of these animals who have been rounded up from our federal lands. And we've got more than 50,000 of them in holding facilities. And now two-thirds of the budget of the Bureau of Land Management is now going to care for captive horses when the BLM was supposed to be having a wild horse management program. and the Roundups have been identified as inhumane, and there are all sorts of problems with it. And Chris, you mentioned the slaughter connection, that some of these horses are being acquired by killer buyers, and they're posing as people who are going to care for these horses, but then they actually shuttle them down to Mexico, and then they're slaughtered there and shipped to Europe or Asia for human consumption. This is, again, one of those hidden problems that we and others are trying to expose. And we're trying to get our federal government not just to stop the mismanagement of wild horses, but to stop the live shipment of horses to Mexico and Canada for slaughter for human consumption.
Now, the Wild Horse Management Program might be the worst program in the federal government. I mean, it's just horrible, and we're going to get into that more in hour four of tonight's program. But thanks for calling, Chris. We go now to Stacy in Oxbridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you and people like you, Wayne, that have a voice for the animals, because truly they're smarter than people give them credit for. And just because we have the so-called opposable thumb, it doesn't mean we should, abuse the animals, because they don't really have a voice. They're truly the silent victims. So I just wanted to say thank you for being a voice for the animals, because people should be.
Well, thank you. You know, we humans have immense power over animals, and how we handle that power is a test of our character. You know, we can choose to be cruel or we can be kind. And obviously, you know, in my book, The Humane Economy, I call for us as a society to show greater kindness. And it's going to be better for business. It's going to be better for government. It's not going to be a sacrifice. It's going to make us a stronger society.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stacy. Go east of the Rockies. Mark in Maryland. Hi, Mark. You're on with Wayne Pacelli.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Pacelli, I want to thank you for everything that you do. I'm with you 100%. I get a lot of letters from all kinds of animal support groups. Like you said, there's like 25,000 of them, but the one that I give most of my money to is the Humane Society. And anyway, here's my question. You know, when I was a little kid, my parents used to take me to the zoo, and I used to love the elephants, and they'd take me to the SeaWorld, and I, you know, loved to see Shamu and all that. And now that they're being taken away, I'm just wondering, you know, for my own children, where am I going to be able to take my own children to see elephants?
Well, thank you for your support. I really appreciate it, and it means so much to us at the Humane Society of the U.S. You know, one of the things that I do talk about in my book is that we have access to information that was never available to us. Now we have nature programming. We've got the Internet. Obviously, there's a lot more information on ecotourism opportunities, people going with their travel and using their dollars not just to enjoy these natural areas, but also to help these local economies flourish and to give value to the protection of wildlife. You know, for those who can't afford that sort of experience or who don't feel it's satisfying enough to have the visual treatment or the online treatment of these issues, you know, we still do have more than 200 accredited zoos and aquariums in the United States. Many of them are getting better and better in terms of the way that they're handling their responsibilities with animals. We still have a problem of 2,000 roadside zoos and menageries that are doing an awful job that send a terrible signal about conservation, about the treatment of animals. So there's a big gap between these accredited zoos and these non-accredited ones, and we urge all of you listeners to be discerning and not to patronize these unaccredited roadside menageries.
You know, we have so many animals that used to be an entertainment here in Nevada, stashed in ranches and out-of-the-way places in rural counties, and people who own them don't feed them very well because they no longer make money for them. They still have, they abuse them terribly. They breed them. They try to make money off of them, but it's a terrible life, and there doesn't seem to be any way to get these animals out of the hands of the people that have them.
Well, sometimes, you know, once they're done with them, they cast them off, and then the animal welfare community has to pick up the animals and then pay the tab. You know, I was talking with someone. We've got a conference in Washington, D.C. right now this weekend called Taking Action for Animals, and one of our co-sponsors is a group called Big Cat Rescue. Well, they've got 80 big cats They didn't create one of those problem situations. They've come in to help animals who were victimized by some person who exhibited some ignorant behavior. And now this group has to spend millions of dollars caring for the discards, just like the Humane Society of the United States and other animal welfare groups do that. This is part of the economic analysis that I do in my book. Why should we be picking up the tab for people who make reckless decisions? Why shouldn't we have policies at the local, state, and federal level to prevent people from having exotic wild animals in their homes or in a roadside menagerie in the first place?
Yeah, it's like boxers and rappers who have tigers and other exotic cats, and rich people with too much money on their hands who think it's really cool to have a wild exotic animal in the backyard. I don't get it.
Well, and then they realize that there's a big expense, there may be a safety risk, and then they dump the animal on us. When we took three tigers at our Black Beauty Ranch who were in some terrible facility in Kansas, we then assumed a 15 to 20 year liability. We then had to build an enclosure for more than $500,000. Again, why is it the responsibility of animal welfare groups to pick up the pieces when someone makes a terrible, stupid decision? And shouldn't we have policies to prevent that person from acquiring a tiger in the first place?
We've got about 2 minutes left, Wayne. We didn't get into the end chapter where you deal with advice for people and what kinds of things they can do. I guess, but here seems to be a good point. I mean, you know, I guess the basic thing is just to think about what you do with your dollars, to think about the impact of the decisions you make.
Yes, I mean, voting with your dollars is one of the most important things you as a consumer can do, because animals are everywhere in the economy. They're in the food production system. They're built into the research and development practices of cosmetics companies, chemical companies, and the like. They're in fashion. Obviously, being an advocate and being involved in government and trying to drive policies is important. Contacting your federal and state and local elected officials, joining groups like the Humane Society of the United States, where you can become part of a larger collective enterprise. But I think, you know, the basic core responsibility is to be educated. I mean, I wrote this book, The Humane Economy, so that people could really get a big picture view of how they can plug into our cause and make a difference and drive change for the world. So I hope people do order the book, pick it up at a bookstore, get educated, get involved. Don't be a bystander. Try to help us help animals in this society. There's been too much cruelty, but we're making a lot of progress, and I think that's a model for future progress for us.
Hey, it feels like something has changed, that a switch has been flipped.
It really has, and I think it's because we now accept the idea that animal cruelty is wrong. We now know that animals are intelligent, they've got their own emotions, they've got their social lives. The old days where animals were just things and operating purely by instinct is over. We now recognize that we humans have all of this creativity and ingenuity. We can solve these problems. We can figure out a way past animal cruelty. We can live good lives as people and not leave a trail of animal victims in our wake.
Wayne Pacelli, great to have you here as always. Thanks. I hope people will check out the book. It's called The Humane Economy, and it's a great read.
Thank you so much, George.
All right. When we come back, the very thorny issue of trophy hunting. Some big money involved in trophy hunting by folks who want to go after rhinos and lions and other members of the so-called Big Five species. And when we come back, we're going to jump into that with somebody who's on the front lines of that issue.